advertising teaching. One is, of course, they don't want to pay for it if teachers really would become, you know, treated as professionals. Two, teachers have, you know, much too much autonomy for their taste as true professionals. And three, that it's, you know, the professionals are much more powerful politically. And, of course, they're still trying to do in the two teachers' unions because we're the only ones that are left protecting public education. Mm-hmm. So I just thought that in retrospect, it's forced me to rethink what's happening to us in the light of 20 years' worth of effort to professionalize teaching. We're putting the final pieces in right now, the pay and the leadership. And it's all a whole piece. It's a whole profession. And yet, NCLB and the lack of good site leadership is throwing us back very rapidly into an industrial model. Mm. And I think it's pretty scary. So those are the struggles that have been going on in my head lately.
Right.
And one slightly encouraging thing is that the Wallace Foundation had a small meeting just a few weeks ago in which there were three union goons in the room that were invited, and I think one superintendent, one state commissioner of education, a couple of ex-big-time superintendents, and then a handful of Wallace staff. And it was a good discussion. Oh, and one researcher. Julia was there. And it was a really good discussion about what on earth are we going to do about leadership?
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know I think they're going to have some more discussions about that, but I think if Wallace Foundation decides it's going to do something good about leadership, maybe that could be hopeful. If they just decide they're going to reinforce what is and do more of the same, I don't know that that's going to be very helpful. Broad got involved in they have their leadership academy.
So all these different institutions are worried about the next generation of leadership.
Yeah.
Has anybody looked back and see what the worry is and what was actually fixed? It seems like they would all have their different theories of what could be the next leader and how to approach it.
Well, I don't think they're looking at back or at what is the problems with what is now enough. No. I think they have their ideas. The business people think it ought to be the business model.
Mm-hmm.
The researchers think it ought to be I'm not sure what they think it ought to be. and the existing education leaders sort of are just think more standards and more training of the same will be enough.
Mm-hmm.
And the teachers are just totally frustrated but don't know what to do about it.
Yeah, the usual spot
for
teachers.
Exactly. And they just, I mean, their frustration just bubbles and then boils over. And there's two school sites in this town right now where teachers are frightened, they're being intimidated, and they are so scared that the current principal that they're working under is gonna be there next year.
Mm-hmm.
And if the current principal is gonna be there next year, they're gonna bid out because the fear factor. Because they operate out of fear and out of stupidity and out of not knowing or caring a twit about the teachers, about having the teachers' backs, about supporting the teachers. They don't know a twit about teaching and learning. They totally operate out of fear. Now, the reason that's worrisome, I think, is that that's what's happening in the private sector workplace. Mm-hmm. Everybody in this country in their workplace is fearful. They're fearful of losing their job. They're fearful of somebody shooting them. They're fearful of that if they lose their job, they're never going to find another one. They're never going to find another one with benefits. They're never going to find another one with the kind of salary that they're currently getting. And this pervasive atmosphere of fear in the workplace in this country is just debilitating, particularly in schools where teachers need to be, you know, calm and understanding and need to be focused on those kids and their needs. Mm-hmm. So the, you know, the trick, or the, I suppose you could say the challenge, an overused word, but the challenge of a teacher union leader and district leaders is that our work is two-tiered, in that the work of the district administrators and the union, if it's done well, is to work to support the adults at the work site so that they are resourced, they have the materials they need, they have the support they need, they have the training they need, they have the space they need, whatever. And then the adults at the work site are the ones that produce the real outcomes, the real results with the kids in their classrooms. So it's this two-step process that's always difficult to prove. It's always difficult to resource. It's always difficult for those out in the public to understand, because you can't just, as a superintendent, for instance, you can't just say, "Well, I do everything." I care about the kids, and every decision I make is made thinking about how it affects kids. Wrong. That isn't what the superintendent ought to be doing. The superintendent ought to be figuring out how the principal administrators and the teachers and the paraprofessionals at the school site, how he can support them, because he is never going to be sitting in a classroom teaching a kid. Mm-hmm. So he can't leap over those adults at the school site and say he's making all his decisions, you know, in relation to how it affects kids. He has no clue how it affects kids most of the time, unless it's buses. So we had a superintendent like that one time, and he said that, and it was evident that he didn't have concern for the adults at those school sites, didn't have the understanding that he needed to, that those were his span of control, if you will, and that the students were the responsibility of the site administrators and the teachers. He also had a real difficult time at first in building a relationship with me, because he just couldn't understand a union leader that really cared.
Right.
And because he had come from, I think it was Grand Rapids, Michigan, and he said that the union leader there always told him that if the kids would start paying dues, he'd start caring about them.
Oh, that old Shanker quote. That they misinterpreted.
Right.
Over and over. Yeah.
And so... He had a hard time at the beginning, you know, trusting me, but we worked it out.
But did he communicate that with the community, saying, I don't care what they're doing in the classrooms. I'm caring about getting them the funds and the resources they need to teach the kids. Because it kind of sounds like he doesn't care.
Well, he did care, but he just sort of didn't know how to do it.
Oh, okay. He had the idea.
Yeah.
But just know how to deliver.
Yeah.
Which is a tough bargain to... It's a tough balancing act.
Right. The other part that... This is a total digression, but the other part is that he was... He was, what's that, he was a Southern European short male from, is it an island off of Italy?
Sicily?
Not Sicily. Portuguese.
Oh, okay.
He was Portuguese. That's probably not where it is, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, I always called him the little Portuguese guy.
Oh, geez.
And I did that after he left. Principal's forum had a party for somebody, and I called him the little Portuguese guy, and they almost fell over on the floor. Anyway, his problem at being a little Portuguese guy is that he had that temperament, which is that he would blow up and rant and rave and have a conniption fit and, you know, lose his temper and blast. And then for him it was over. And then everything was fine. And, you know, he'd go on. What he didn't understand is German Scandinavians. So the German Scandinavians around him never said a word. They just kind of backed up and let him blast, but they waited and waited. And when he got in trouble with the board, there wasn't a soul behind him.
Right.
So they got him in the end.
So wrong fit on personalities as
mm-hmm.
well, and ethnicity.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We're known for our thick contract.
You have a gigantic contract.
We do. Well, you know, some people advocate the thin contract.
Yeah.
And I think a thin contract is fine if you have the kind of relationship with the superintendent and the school district that's sustainable over time, because a thin contract means you've got to maintain those kinds of relationships in order to continue to operate.
Right.
And if things change, then what? You don't have anything embedded in writing anywhere. So unless you've got a heck of a lot of memoranda of agreement. So we've kind of gone the opposite way, and I always say we're like Prego. It's in there. If whatever you want to know, it's in there. And so we've put all the standards in there. We've put the rubrics in there. We've put all the processes in there. We've put everything we can possibly think of embedded in the contract, because as district administrators and school boards never like to hear me say that policy manuals are useless.
Yeah.
Nobody ever opens them. And they sit on the shelf and collect dust. But the teacher's contract is really a manual for reform. And anything anybody wants to know about how things ought to operate, it's in that book. Now, the problem comes with... if the district ignores it, because there is a stuff in there that they ignore. If they would follow it, life would be a lot better.
Mm-hmm.
But they do ignore it. But by having it in the contract, we think that it does empower teachers, and they can always go to that document as kind of a Bible for support and reform.
See, some people think that those kind of reforms should stay with the policy created by the city council with the help of the union, because it's dealing more with it's the communities issues.
Yeah, in this town, the school board, city council, and the mayor don't have anything to do with the schools here.
Okay, so it's a different environment.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I don't know. Maybe life would be grand if we had, you know, a trust agreement, and but it also means that you're sort of always renegotiating things in some ways. If it's a living document, you're always nothing ever stays the same. And part of what drives teachers nuts is the constant churning and the constant change and the change in philosophy and the change in policies and the change in curriculum and the change in materials and the change in books and change in leadership. And it's amazing that they survive.
They are constantly surrounded by not only internal council level, their own union, but they're also getting attacked constantly outside of the national press.
Constantly.
And the cable, and even the president attacks them.
Right.
So no wonder they're living in fear.
Well, the parents are becoming much more powerful, much more vocal, and, you know, kind of, as we talked about, wanting their first choice and their only choice for their kid as their teacher, and that. So the big subject in this town right now is teacher seniority.
Is it?
It's the biggest. It's on. There's been a television show on it.
Mm-hmm.
There's been several open forums at League of Women Voters on it. Mm-hmm. There have been. It's been the subject of the area parent advisory councils. And it's just, it's the big buzz.
Hmm. This year or next year?
Well, maybe. This year, and it has been for the last couple.
Just
last
looking
two or three.
At why they have such high seniority, or?
No, actually, it's probably the last 5 years, because, of course, nobody ever said boo when we were growing and hiring and increasing. It all hit the fan with the major layoffs. And so with the decrease, you know, in Detroit, in Cleveland, in all of the places where we're seeing significant decline, and you impose the normal rules of layoff, they don't like that. And I continually try to explain that when you... we've had, you know, layoffs of 500, layoffs of 300, and when you have the layoffs of that many people, you have to have a decision maker or decision point that is as infallible as you can get. You cannot have decisions made about who's going to end up on the street without employment, without a paycheck, without probably much hope of getting employment at that level, by whim or personality or one person's biases or one person's observations. It just isn't good enough.
Mm.
And that's not acceptable to them.
Mm.
So... and it's just not here. It's a big deal everywhere it's happening.
Right.
As to whether teachers are going to be governed by, you know, the rules of layoff that are embedded in law, or whether they're going to be, whether the principal single-handedly is going to have the say as to who they get to keep and who they get to jettison.
Right.
I think that we probably, in this thick contract, the Sears catalog, no, now we have to say JCPenney catalog. Sears catalog is gone. We do have lots of different rewards for National Board certification. We also have, I think what's new, maybe unique, is that we have several different kinds of sabbatical leaves. Probably five different kinds of sabbatical leaves. And so we've been very, been leaders in sabbatical leaves. Hmm. I think that the Minneapolis Federation of Teachers has an image and has respect in the teacher union movement because we have put the pieces of the professional puzzle together, and because we have it in the contract. And I think that that is all, so it's observable and it's replicable. And one thing I noticed that when I became president is that there, on the old salary schedule, there were several hundred teachers that were on the old schedule stuck at BA plus 60 credits, bachelor's plus 60 credits. Mm-hmm. And the next lane on the salary schedule would be a master's degree plus 15, I think. And part of the reason, so I started, you know, asking around to find out why teachers were, so many of them were stuck there. There was like 600 of them, I think, that were stuck there. And it turned out that there were two categories of teachers that were stuck there. One was elementary teachers who didn't feel that a master's degree was going to actually help them in their classroom. Mm-hmm. And the other were secondary teachers and or elementary teachers who didn't have the sort of personal self-confidence to do the next degree.
Interesting.
Yeah, I thought it was too. So what I did was I invented our own master's degree program. And our master's degree program was a collaborative program with the University of St. Thomas, which is a private university, but it was known for its entrepreneurial activity,
right,
and openness to do off-campus programs. And they gave us a 50% price break on per credit, and we had we started the first cohort, and we taught our teachers taught five or six of the classes, the required classes, and we used the AFT, ER&D for a couple of them.
Right.
But for instance, I taught organizational change. One of my business agents at the time taught Introduction to Reform, Lynn Nordgren taught professional development and so on. So the university taught half of the courses and we taught half of the courses. And we would also celebrate the fact that when they got their master's, and we went through it, the teachers went through it as a cohort of Minneapolis teachers, so that they, K-12, but they had a common reference, a common frame to have the discussions. When they went through the whole thing as a cohort together of people, at our office, in our office, they got to know each other well. They supported each other, so the lack of self-confidence was overcome because they helped each other. So we had over 500 teachers then get their master's degree through our collaborative program. They were very popular. And so that's a program that I'm really proud of because we designed it and delivered it. It filled a need. We tailored the program so that it was tailored to the needs of Minneapolis teachers. It was tailored to the, you know, the experience of Minneapolis teachers, to the strategies that Minneapolis used. So it was useful to them. And it also gave them some understanding and some skills to become the teacher leaders at their site. In the very first cohort, there were 5 teachers from Patrick Henry High School who decided to do it together. Those were the 5 teachers that went back to Patrick Henry that I went to, and we started the professional practice school. So it not only helped, you know, all these teachers, over 500 teachers, get their master's degree and move on the current salary schedule, but it also spawned a lot of creativity and empowered teachers in some of those cohorts to really be creative when they went back to their buildings.
Right.
So that was as Martha would say, it was a good thing. We in our local, I think, have over the years, not necessarily over the last few years, but over the years that we were in we have been the bargaining agent, I think we probably have had more successes in the court system for teachers than any other local in the state. We brought more legal actions than probably the rest of the state combined and won hundreds of thousands of dollars in settlements for teachers.
Okay.
Then we decided that that was no way to run a railroad, basically.
That's expensive.
Well, and it also maintains the adversarial relationship. It embeds the adversarial relationship. And that's why we tried to go to get the training on how to mediate. So we added mediation as a step, and how to try to get to some principled resolution of issues. So we established a labor management committee with the Human Resources and Labor Relations Department. And it's called contract administration. And contract administration meets generally every other week or sometimes monthly, depending upon how hot the season is.
Right, right.
And so the president and the staff people of the union and the human resources folks and labor relations director meet and try to iron out bring issues to the table, bring problems to the table, bring, you know, things that are going on and try to iron them out before they ever reach a grievance.
Right.
So we have cut the number of grievances through that process way down to where we believed that we could, you know, there wasn't anything we couldn't solve if we all just put our minds to it.
Mm-hmm.
So we knew then that if it became a grievance or if it went to court, it was really something that was a sticking point.
Right.
We did take Superintendent Jennings to court because he was going to try to freeze our salaries one fall. And we kept telling him that, you can't do that. We're on a continuing contract in this state, and you can't do that because we're on a continuing contract according to the language in our contract.
Right.
And all those things, but oh no, he wouldn't pay any attention. Um, One of the other really, the things I'm really proud of is that are the is the success of the three class size referendums that we passed in this town.
Okay.
Starting in 89, I believe, we decided that a class size was something that people could get their arms around and then would be willing to support.
Mm-hmm.
So we put a levy referenda on the ballot, and we said that we would, and with that levy referenda, we would significantly lower class size, and we would retrain teachers to teach differently in the smaller class size. That was the first one. So there was money in there for additional teachers, additional space, and for training retraining teachers. We won that one, in spite of the fact that in this town there's only about now probably 13 to 15% of the households have kids in the schools. Well, it's down to probably 13% now.
Well,
the gentrification of this city has, over recent years, has just happened like crazy. So we have very, I think first referenda it was 17%.
Mm-hmm.
Second referenda, then we renewed it, and I think it was down to about 15% then. And then the third time we renewed it was for 8 years, and that I think the probably was the 13% figure of families. So what we knew and played out and was reinforced by the vote is that it wasn't just the parents that could grasp the issue of class size.
Right.
Everybody can grasp the issue of class size because they know, the parents know instinctively that if there are fewer kids in the room, their kid's going to get more attention from the teacher.
Okay.
What the teachers know is that fewer kids in the room, the broader the range of student needs they can reach and take care of in the classroom. The larger the class, the narrower range of needs the teacher has time to deal with. So all those are things that people get in their gut.
Right.
They understand them. The third time, we passed it by 72%. Phenomenal.
So how did you convince those who are parents, who aren't teachers,
mm-hmm.
how they grasp it?
Well, it's a quality of life for them.
There we go.
And they know that if the schools... the only shot at safety and at keeping their home values up and keeping their neighborhoods is to have the kids be successful.
Did you educate them on that, or they just figured it out?
Both.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Plus, we had the support of, you know, everybody who was anybody in town.
Yeah.
Plus, we had very little opposition, amazingly little opposition. The Republican Party in this town meets in the back room of a restaurant over here. So they all six of them. So, but the chamber sort of the first time around, the chamber made noises, you know, and opposed it.
Sure.
But the third time around now, and we played a huge role. The union played a huge role in getting that passed. We had our theme was Vote Yes for Kids.
Mm-hmm.
And with the check mark, and we purchased, I think it was 100,000 giant yellow leaf bags in the fall, of course, with the Vote Yes for Kids on it in black. And everywhere in town, people were raking their leaves in late October, and they'd fill these leaf bags with leaves, and then they'd let them sit in their yard.
Cool.
So it was way cool. It was incredible advertising. Some people lined them all up along their fence, and some people, you know, they hung them over their fence and used them as a sign. And when we were standing on bridges over the freeway the day of the vote, people were wearing them and, you know, stuck their feet and arms through them.
Yeah.
They were the best idea anybody's ever had, and people have tried to replicate it since then, but you have to do it on a grand scale because they don't make those bags, you know, they don't make 5,000 of them. So we still have some of those bags, but it, and then we did the usual lawn signs and the flyers, and we did education about class size, the research on class size. So we had flyers on that. We had big, you know, the full color fancy postcards that went to all that typical stuff. But the thing that really, really was the standout were the garbage bags.
Huh.
Or the leaf bags.
Yeah.
And the great tragedy of all of that, oh, and the union put in tremendous amounts of money and staff time.
Sure.
We funded that big time. And I don't think anybody will ever know how much we actually put in because I never told anybody. But and we all AFT sent us a staff person and for the last one, and so it was a big deal. The great tragedy is that once Governor Pawlenty got to be governor and the Republicans took over the legislature, they cut funding for the schools so significantly, and the Minneapolis schools student population dropped so significantly after 9/11, when the immigrants weren't coming anymore.
Yeah,
that finally about three, four years ago. The school board finally had cut everything else, and they just had to go back on the class size promise.
Yeah.
And of course now, the money is still coming in until fall 2008, because we timed it specifically to be the presidential election year.
That's good.
Because that's when, you know, the most voters come out, and you got a better shot at it. And but. You know, now the everybody's saying, well, why should we support that again? They went back on it, and I don't know, it's going to be a really hard sell this time.
Mm-hmm.
And class sizes were brought down to 19-1 for K-1-2, 24-1 for 3-5, or was it 3-8? 3-8, I think, and then 26-1 at the high school.
Wow.
It was really good.
Hmm.
We also, that kind of reminds me of a couple other things we did. This was probably late 80s, early 90s. We started a school that was started with the cooperation of General Mills Foundation, the Wheaties people.
Yeah.
And it was a school that they wanted to pattern after the best of the private schools. And so it was called the Public School Academy because it was kind of named and patterned after the private school academy, St. Paul Academy and Summit School, which is a very posh private school in St. Paul. And it was going to have an absolute class size of 14-1.
Mm.
Absolutely not one more. And the parents were going to agree to be there and be involved. And the teachers then, if they were going to have 14 kids in a classroom, they were going to agree to do all of the extras in the classroom. So they were going to agree to do music, art, special ed, all of the multiple needs. They were going to take care of in their classroom because they only had 14 kids.
Right.
And it worked beautifully for a number of years. It finally went under Well, it just got absorbed because of lousy leadership. And the foundation really didn't want to get its hands dirty and get involved in the leadership question, which I thought was really odd. And I know the foundation people really well. And I'd beg them to get involved, but they wouldn't touch that part of it. So it died because of lousy leadership. We did another school called Chiron, School of the Future, which was supposed to be sort of an Chiron, which I named, actually, which was a school that was a school in the community, and it was in three different locations. And so it was a middle school, and one location was Basilica building. One was in a downtown office building, and one was over on the St. Paul Farm campus for the science location. And the kids would circulate between those locations.
Oh, neat.
And therefore they had experiences in the real world. They had we put a lot of elbow grease and a lot of work in getting that school up and running. And there again, it was supposed to be kind of a model for an in-district charter. People chose to be there.
Right.
It was experiential. The kids made presentations of their learnings at the end of the trimester or the semester. They'd have these, parents would come in and professors and everybody else would come in and the kids would present their learning. So it was authentic assessment. It was great. There again, it got absorbed, and B, the leadership really went downhill.
What do you mean by absorbed?
Well, the district just kept whittling away at its special dispensations, so that instead of having, for instance, citywide bus service, so to get the kids into the, they would cut them back so they could only gather from part of the city. And in order to have buses during the day to get the kids from the downtown site to the St. Paul site, you needed buses during the middle of the day, and they cut back and wouldn't fund that. And, it's just... It often happens that way with really great experimental sites. They work for a while, and then it's really hard to sustain them.
Is one, because of leadership, I imagine.
Yep.
Two, I could see that just the funding. You have to keep cutting back.
And the district, a big bureaucracy, excuse me, always sort of... works to bring things to the sort of common look.
To standardize.
Centralize and standardize. And the oddballs are always easy to pick off. The same thing happened with our year-round school. We had a school of extended learning.
Uh-huh.
And we negotiated different contracts for those teachers, and the teachers did staggered days so they could do 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. or whatever it was. And year-round extended school of extended... It was so good that, of course, the district did away with the extended bus service and with with the extended janitorial service and all the rest of this stuff, and there again, it got absorbed. So it's too bad that sort of the normal activity of the bureaucracy doesn't tolerate the really good outliers. And it's very difficult to have other schools learn from them.
Oh, sure.
Other schools really would rather not learn from them, because somebody's always saying that, the outliers are better than they are, and it's hard for them to learn.
Yeah.
This is out of place here, but through in negotiations after we had the training from the and we did principled bargaining, getting to yes, getting to we divided the issues up into subcommittees, and we had a lot of teachers involved and involved in subcommittees, and then the subcommittees would bring the information back to the negotiations table. So we opened up negotiations. I haven't mentioned the radio show yet. In 2005, I began doing an hour-long radio show every Saturday on Air America Minnesota, which is the local, obviously, the local Air America affiliate. It's called Education Matters, Your Children, Our Future. And it's a program in which I do both programs, interviews, and information about education issues and labor issues.
Right.
So it's partly funded by the Minneapolis Central Labor Union Council, and so that's been a way to get information to the public about what we do in depth, about issues that we think they ought to be knowledgeable of, and issues that maybe they can help with, because once in a while we ask them to call a legislature or call their congressperson.
Any memorable shows?
Well, I think one good show that was a show on higher ed. We had the AFT Human Rights, or the, I guess it was called a super conference, when, not too many, when was it, a couple years ago?
Three years ago? In Philly?
No, it was here in Minneapolis.
Okay.
And it was co-sponsored by the Higher Ed Division and Human Rights and Human Civil Rights and Community Relations and Women's Rights. And I don't remember, ER&D might have been here too, but anyway, since higher ed was here, I interviewed Bill Scheuerman.
Right.
And that was a really, that was a good interview. But I think the most memorable ones were the ones that I did right after Katrina. Mm-hmm. And I interviewed you know, the women leaders of those unions down there, and I caught them. Well, I had a little help, but for with numbers, but I got them by cell phone, and they really were amazed that I tracked them down. But and I interviewed them within a week after the and I did about it was either three or four shows on Katrina. At various times, I interviewed one young woman who came up here after the teacher, a New Orleans teacher who came up here, because I think she had family up here, and I interviewed her. But the rest of the time, I interviewed like Marianne Grashik and Brenda and a lot of the folks down there, and I think those were probably some of the most powerful ones.
Sure.
And then the ones that there was a really good show on North High School, because we have a sort of a we have a city council member who represents North Minneapolis who's Jamaican. And you know, for people who don't understand Jamaicans, they're rather outspoken.
Yeah.
And rather energetic about being outspoken. And to them, it's just discussion, but it sounds like attack. Anyway, he made the the ill-thought-out statement that North High School ought to be burned down because it was so, you know, not doing the job.
Right.
Well, of course, the community took offense. The students took offense. Everybody just had a fit. And his wife, the council member's wife, is a big charter school proponent. So there was political, you know, behind the scenes going on there. So I went over to North High School and I interviewed kids, and it was really, it was good because the kids over North High School is heavily kids of color, heavily African American, and these kids were so articulate, and articulate in saying what North High School meant to them, what they were going to do with their, some of them were they're getting their education at the Sumatech with math, science, technology magnet there, and what they were going to do with their lives and where they were going to go to college, and the fact that they had come to Sumatech as a personal challenge to themselves to keep interested and keep learning, and because they knew that the pressure would be on in Sumatech so that they to learn, and if they went someplace else they'd probably slack off and and, you know, not learn as much and not challenge themselves. It really was a good show, and I've given out several copies of it on CDs so that people could listen to it. Somebody said they were going to give it to the council member. I don't know if he's ever listened to it or not.
Yeah, I was about to ask because I think some of it.
Right. And let's see. I've done some remotes. I'm going to do a remote the Saturday after next when the letter carriers do their food drive.
Right.
And I do a remote from the state fair. We always have the studio out at the state fair, right behind, between the sheep barn and the horse barn.
I bet that smells lovely.
Well, actually, there's, luckily, right behind us, there's a Cinnabon. So the smell of cinnamon overpowers all the rest. And right by the Hippodrome, of course, where all of the the shows are.
So you address a local labor issues, or do you also do the national?
Both. Yeah. I've done one on the, you know, the big issue of the day, the in the Congress. The
Employee Rights Act.
Yeah, what's it? That's not a...
That's not good, but...
Isn't that awful? Well, we'll come up with it eventually.
Mm-hmm.
And I, because I can, you know, interview by phone, of course, I can do national interviews, but it's always more fun to have people in the studio.
Sure.
And so that you can interact. This goes way back to that our benefits discussion, so it probably should be inserted back with that benefits discussion where I got that legislation passed for the match. There's one other one other benefits issue that we were very early, like a decade ago, we put language in our contract for domestic partner benefits. And ever since then, we've been kind of quiet about it because the city workers had domestic partner benefits in their contract, and it got to be a big political issue in the city, and it got removed. And now it's a big issue at the in the state legislature right now.
Well, we got rid of it in ours.
So we've always just, I've always been very quiet about it and kept it way under the radar. Hopefully, you know, hoping nobody sort of knows it's there.
Yeah, because our legislature knows it's in all our public employee contracts, and they just ruled, the courts ruled that they cannot be part of the contract.
Mm-hmm.
So they got rid of for everybody. That's the social unionism
right
issue.
And the other thing that's happening in the legislature, I just heard this morning on our way in, is that as a part of one of the health bills at the legislature, they're putting in a provision that domestic partners can visit ill people in the emergency room and in the urgent care, and
right.
I'm still not picking up the right word for when you're in intensive care.
Yeah.
And make decisions.
Life
and death decisions.
That's a big issue as well right now.
So it's a big deal. So we're trying to continue to, but I've felt good about the fact that it's there and that it hasn't been attacked yet.
Okay.
We do quite a bit of sending, teachers around the country talking about a lot of the stuff in our contract and talking about a lot of our programs. Oh, I know what I was going to say. When I became president, no, I'll start out before I became president. In the early 80s, the then president of the Federation wanted to buy a piece of land in South Minneapolis. I think it was on 35th in Chicago. Anyway, it's and build a four-story union office.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, of course, we had a lot of people in the union and could have afforded it. And the upper level, the credit union was going to be there, and the upper level was going to be a social area. And he got a little expansive, shall we say, about his description of what the fourth floor was going to be like. And the teachers got, I don't know whether they got nervous or didn't like it or whatever, but when the vote came as to whether it was going to happen or not, the yeses were a majority, but a bare majority. Mm-hmm. It was like maybe 51%. So they decided not to build it. So that meant that we were still, wherever we were renting. We rented in the Labor Temple for years until, of course, the Labor Temple was torn down. Then we went to a one little one-story building out on 22nd and Nicollet. And then when that round of 18 schools was were closed by Richard Green, we rented a school and held our meetings in the lunchroom, and it worked out well until they opened the school again. So then we had to go someplace else. And then I talked to Dr. Green into selling me a building that the district owned, which was formerly a funeral home on Plymouth Avenue. And in Minneapolis, on Plymouth Avenue is kind of historic in that it's the avenue that burned down in the riots.
Mm-hmm.
And in the late 60s, early 70s, the whole avenue burned. And it's considered, in the middle of what we laughingly call our ghetto, but in Minneapolis it isn't really. So he sold it to me for a song. It had been, the school district had bought it to run talking typewriters during the 70s. And talking typewriters was a federal program for kids that didn't know how to read. And it was kind of an early version of computer-based learning.
Sure, yeah.
And it was, so it was pretty interesting. But then, of course, the federal money dried up. They didn't need the building anymore. They rented it to a daycare that put absolutely outrageous carpeting on the floor because, the little puzzles and the little numbers and everything. And then outrageous things on the walls. And then it had been vacant for about 3 years. And after it had been vacant for about 3 years, it had been vandalized. A car had actually gone through one of the walls. And so it was in pretty tough shape. But when I went inside, I could see